Good evening. It's 7 o'clock. I'm Ty, and this is Ty Tunes. You're listening to WRFNLP Pasco, Radio Free Nashville. You can listen to us at 107.1 if you're in the Bellevue, Kingston Springs area, otherwise on the internet at radiofreenashville.org. John Scott Sherrill is my guest this evening, and we'll be bringing him on air and having him share his thoughts and experiences with us and his music, and that'll be momentarily, but here's some of his music.
Way across town, the phone rings off the wall. If you know he ain't home, why do you keep calling? You're gonna drive yourself crazy. You know that it's true. It's just making you wild and blue. Wild. The shades are pulled down. Someone is trying to satisfy you. He don't know you're just wild and blue. Wild and blue. And it's no wonder. Look at the things that you do. They could just take you up yonder, honey. You're already wild. I never thought I'd find
Thank you.
It's the music of John Scott Cheryl, and John is sitting right here across from me. John, thanks so much for coming out, man.
Ty, thank you very much, man.
So, 11 number one songs that you've penned.
And counting.
And counting. That is an awesome achievement. That's the congratulations. That's exciting. And this song, so John, is this something that's out and available for purchase, or is that your own personal?
Oh, no, this is just an old publisher's attempt to flog some of my songs.
Okay. Well, we listened to Wild and Blue, Woman Like a Song, and Down Will Come Baby. And John has a number one cut out right now with Josh Turner that we're going to listen to. Would you go with me? You want to say anything about this song setting
well,
it up?
Or? Except for the fact that it's not right now. It was a year or so ago.
Well, but, sort of now.
For people of our generation, that's right now.
Good point.
Yeah, this is a song I wrote with Sean Camp, and it's a lot of fun. If at some point I could play Sean's version of it that doesn't have a chorus. Because Sean and I wrote it, and Sean even put it on his record, and there was no chorus, and Josh heard it and said, well, that's a good song. I wish it had a chorus. So he called Sean up, and Sean and I got back together, and we wrote a chorus for it. So that's how this song has a beautiful chorus.
Is there a story behind the lyric, how you came up with the concept and the words and
oh, and I think all of that sort of thing? It was probably just Sean wanting some girl to go with him, as far as I know. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Let's roll it. Here we
okay.
go.
Summer sun got higher. If we roll from town to town and never shut it down, would you go with me? If we were lost in fields of clover, would we walk even closer until the trip was over? And would it be okay if I didn't know the way? If I gave you my hand, would you take it and make me the happiest man in the world? If I told you my heart couldn't beat one more minute without you, girl, would you accompany me to the edge of the sea? Let me know if you're really a dream. So would you go with me? Look down forever. If you were lighter than a feather, oh, and if I set you free, would you go with me? If I gave you my hand, would you take it and make me the happiest man in the world? If I told you my heart couldn't beat one more minute without you, girl, you accompany me to the edge of the sea. Help me tie up the ends of a dream. I gotta know, would you go with me? I love you so much.
Scott Sherrill wrote that song with Sean Camp.
Yeah.
And Josh Turner took it to number one. Man, that is an awesome song. That's still being played on the 3:30 sessions. You ever watch that?
Yeah.
I saw that not too long ago. That stayed on the charts. You have any idea for how long?
Well, it hung around there a lot longer than most.
Is it still on there?
No, but it's still in the hearts and minds.
That's right. Do you subscribe to Billboard and study what's charting and pay attention to who's doing what?
You know, I used to do that, and I can't say I do it anymore because I don't know these youngsters.
You moved to Nashville when?
1975.
And what was it that, what was on your mind when you came here?
Well, I was in a little hippie band up in New Hampshire called the Family of Pan. And
the guy with the flute.
Yes, the guy with the flute and the goat and the goat
and the goat feet.
Yeah, and we got a chance to record a little bit for Elektra Records down in New York City. Give me my first taste of the studio. And when the band broke up, I had the chance to come. I was going to go to L.A. and become a rock star, but on the way there, I was going to stop off in Nashville and see a guy named Rob Galbraith, who was a friend of the folks that were doing the stuff at Elektra. And, man, once I got here, I couldn't leave. Never made it to LA.
And how long was it after you hit town that you had your first record on the radio?
It was easily 5 years or...
When you,
maybe a little bit more.
Have you heard it said that this is a 5-year town and a 10-year town and all that sort of thing? Have you heard those sayings?
Yeah.
You think it's true?
Well, to get your foot in the ground, maybe 5 years, but that's old school thinking now. We're talking about these guys coming in with their lawyers and their SUVs and their agents and their managers and everything. Probably takes 6 years now.
So
I don't know, man.
It took 5 years. So were you hitting it pretty hard for 5 years?
Well, in the beginning, I was still a hippie, and I didn't really realize the value of hard work.
Ah.
So I spent 2 years kind of sitting on top, quite literally sitting on top of a van. We put a couch up on top of a van that was broken down out in front of our house, and put the couch up there. We had a nice view of the dental office across the street. And there was a dental office, and if you wanted a better view, there was a gas station right next to the dental office. And so we had a choice of two great views, and we sat there for two summers drinking malt duck and talking politics and philosophy and occasionally writing a song.
What was the scene like in Nashville then compared to now in terms of writer nights and being able to get out and have people hear? You know, today you might go to a writer's night and somebody say, you know, I wrote this on the way to the writer's night and here it is and it's brand new and check it out. And I mean, was the scene at all like what it is now?
Well,
were there writer nights?
Yeah, oh yes, there were. And okay. That was I'd never heard of such a thing, by the way, you know. Mm-hmm. A writer's night.
Yeah,
when I got here, the first one I remember was at Frankenstein's, which was hot dogs and beers.
So yeah,
you remember that club?
No,
it was on West End, and I'd only been here a few days when I went over there, and I couldn't believe it, man. These people were writing songs that could completely slay you in 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes, or else bring you up and make you want to dance in 2.5-3 minutes. And my hippie songs were 10 minutes long, you know, and changed tempos and keys and subject matter. So it was quite an eye-opening experience to me. To be around real Nashville songwriters was, I guess that's what the first eye-opening thing was, really, to me here.
You know? So that have a pretty big impact on your writing?
Oh, yeah. I was blessed enough to be involved with Combine Music early on. That's where Rob Galbraith was writing. And I just got to run into these true geniuses, a whole stable full of them who knew what was going on and treated it like a university where the every day was a learning opportunity. It was amazing. It really was.
Who were some of those folks that you got to hear and maybe meet and get to know later on, became people that were charting and went on to have pretty successful careers as writers and artists and things?
Oh, yeah. Well, the folks that I first ran into over there were, you know, people like Dennis Lindy and Chris Christopherson and Tony Joe White and Lee Clayton and all the great stable of folks that
sweet.
Beckham had gathered around. You know, nobody was the same as anybody else. Everybody had a different personality, but a different spark about the music and different approach to everything. And it's pretty magic.
Did you begin co-writing with people at that time?
Yeah, and that was another new experience for me. You know, we were used to just dawdling away and dwindling along in our little world, which was fun too. And I still do that a lot, you know.
Yeah,
because you got to write by yourself. I think, you know, to find out who you are. But no, co-writing's been wonderful. Man, this town is full of so many wonderful sparks and talents that you can just pick up on.
It sure is. So what was the, just briefly describe the journey from, you know, hitting town to seeing your first songs get picked up and land on the radio and stuff. I mean, how did all that happen? Did somebody discover you at a writer's night, or were you pitching your songs to publishers or to artists directly, or how did you kind of get from where you were to where you now have, you know, all these number one hits behind you and probably a lot of other album cuts and whatever?
Well, in my case, it was more just hanging around Combine until they finally let me stay a little bit. It was, but that's a different era, like we were saying.
Yeah.
I was there, I guess, a couple of years, and the first time I showed up there and played them my songs, they said, well, you're pretty good, but your songs are 10 minutes long and blah, blah, blah. Why don't you do this? Why don't you come in the back door and don't bother going through the secretary trying to put up with all that. Just and go straight upstairs and just hang out and listen to what these people are doing. So I did, and I just hung out and eventually started writing with them and listening and hanging out and figuring out that songs have to do something, and they have to do it pretty quickly. You know, they can't dawdle around like I was, you know. And there was, after that, about 2 years later, so they offered me a deal as a tape copy boy, not a writer.
It's kind of like the martial arts, you know. First, you can chop the wood, you know, before we teach you how to chop people with your fist.
Exactly. Right. But at the time, I was climbing trees as a tree surgeon, and I was making like, I don't know, $19 an hour, which back then was huge money.
Yeah.
Know? And I couldn't quit to be a tape copy boy, but when they offered me to be a writer for $50 a week, I quit my chainsaw job and signed up. And that's how it happened, man. I took such a pay cut from $19 an hour to $50 a week does not go over too good at home, you know, when you bring that equation home.
It's a gamble.
It doesn't really go down too good, but I'm so glad I did because, you know, it eventually got to be $125 a week. It was great.
And that was against future earnings? Yeah. That was kind of like a loan, right?
Right, right.
Somebody told me that there used to be 2,000 riders on the draw at one time, and now that's down to about 200 riders on the draw right as we speak.
Well, I wish I knew who those 200 were. I don't think that's a business model that works anymore. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah. When did things begin to change, you think? You know,
internet.
Which was when? When did that start really
coming? Tell me, you youngster.
I'm going to say, I didn't have a computer till 95. And I think I was slow getting involved because I know people were involved before that. So maybe late 80s, early 90s, a lot of people started getting into the internet and the PCs and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I remember, you know, there was always these panics running through town. At first was the Walkman. Everybody's going to be putting their songs on cassette and walking around and doing their jogging with the cassettes on their heads and not going to be paying for the music. And we thought that was bad. We had no idea, man. We were clueless.
There was that whole Napster, I think, was the first thing.
That was the very first one.
Yeah. So what was your first number one on that got on the radio?
Wild and Blue, John Anderson.
Wild and Blue. Why don't you play that for us?
Okay, man. I'll do that.
John Scott Sherrill.
If you know he ain't home, why do you keep calling? Gonna drive yourself crazy. You know that it's true. It's making you wild and blue, wild and blue. Just no wonder. Look at the things that you do. They could just take you up yonder. You're already wild and blue. In somebody's room on the first side of town, with your minds all made up and the shades all pulled down, someone is trying to satisfy you. You don't know you're wild. Just no wonder. Look at the things that you do. They could just take you up yonder, honey. You're already wild and blue.
Scott Sherrill, and that was a number one song. What year was that, John?
82, I believe.
Wild and Blue. Man, Did you come from a musical family?
My dad sang in the choir, and I grew up around a lot of music because they were big music fans. But other than that, no.
When did you discover a love of music? A pull toward did the Beatles do it?
It might have been. I mean, trying to think. I mean, did we all have to make a choice in high school between football and rock and roll? I don't know.
It was an easy choice for me.
No, I think it was way early on for me, man. I think the my first big loves was folk music and Joan Baez and all that stuff.
Okay. You know, 1960.
I was way young and thought I was, I thought I was an ancient English peasant who was, living on the heath somewhere. I don't know what I thought.
When did you start playing the guitar? How old were you?
Got my first guitar when I was 12, and my first good guitar. I think I had one of those Roy Rogers or guitars with a painting on it before that. But I got a Goya when I was 12, a Swedish guitar. Good one. And it was off to the races from then on.
Are you self-taught, or did you take lessons?
I had lessons. I had a series early on, you know, when I was only 12. My folks said, well, you got to take lessons. And I had such bad luck for my guitar teachers that I quit. One of them turned out to be an alcoholic, or maybe he already was before I started.
You didn't drive him to drink.
I still don't know to this day. Another one died, and the other one divorced, and I said, "Whoa, I better stop this." You know, so from then on, I was getting my friends to teach me something. You know.
But, did Elvis do much for you?
You know, I shouldn't say this on the radio, but
he's okay.
Other than Hound Dog, no.
Okay.
Jailhouse Rock.
How about the Beatles?
Oh yeah, I was a big Beatles fan.
You were in front of your TV set in February of '64 when their first appearance on
It's on?
On television?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I was there. Me and my brother and sister kneeled down in front of the black and white.
You and lots of other folks. Were you good in school and music and linguistic things, spelling and English and things that had to do with words?
No, I was terrible in the music part. I could never read music, so I was always in trouble. You know, and I was good in English, good in history, terrible in math.
Creative writing.
Good in creative writing.
Yeah.
Terrible in science.
You think that's an
terrible? Worse in football.
You think that's an inherited thing?
The football?
No. The word stuff. The gifts that you have now. You think you inherited those, or they came from somewhere in your family?
Oh, I don't doubt it. My folks are both writers, and they come from a long line of writers, and theologians and preachers, which I'm hoping to avoid, but you never know. My daughter is going to be a priest, so.
Have you ever written any Christian songs or gospel songs?
Oh, yeah.
So what was next after that? I mean, how did things change in your life after you had that Wild and Blue success? Did that, like, open up all kinds of doors and opportunities that didn't exist?
It did, but it wouldn't. I don't know. Maybe I'm just different from everybody else. But it didn't happen the way that you think it would, just open up all kind of windows. Maybe I'm not an outgoing kind of personality, you know, that take advantage of something like that. But years went by, and then I got another cut, and years went by, and I got another. That's how come I'm 61 years old, and it's taking me this long to get those cuts, you know. But I don't mind. I'd rather just hope for the best. Miracle. That's what the pooch, Johnny McRae, the vice president at Combine, had a sign on his wall that said, "Expect a miracle." And I guess that's what I took to heart. You know, there's no other way around it, you know. Because it's not going to happen without that.
Where do you think your ideas come from?
Oh, man, I wish you hadn't asked me that. I don't know. I really don't. And I've always wondered that. And you always wonder if there'll be another one. And where's that going to come?
And how do you know it's an idea worth pursuing? I mean, how do you figure out what to keep and work and develop and what to let go? How do you, you know, what's the litmus test or the, your gauge for? Is it just a feeling or an intuition?
That part's a little bit easier than the where do they come from
question,
because if it sends that tingle down you, you know, it might be worth at least pursuing a little bit. And if it just lays there after you played a few, you know, and just doesn't feel like anything's there.
Do you have certain people in your life that you use for like immediate feedback kind of thing other than co-writers?
My wife. She's got a great musical sense and can usually tell a nonsense or bull song from a real one, you know. But that's problematic too, you know, running stuff by your wife, and and sometimes she and I disagree about songs, but not too often.
You ever have a song that you thought sucked and everybody else just loved it, and vice versa, that everybody else loved it and you thought it sucked?
Yeah, that happens all the time, which is, which leads to my my problem as a song plugger. It really does, because I don't know. I might love it, and everybody else says, oh, that's okay, or something. Or else I think it's just kind of pablum, and everybody goes, yeah, that's the stuff.
So what's the process for getting a cut now? Like, you write a song, either alone or with a writer, another writer, and you believe in it, and you want somebody to record it. What happens next?
Well, I wish you could have all your listeners call in and tell me that very thing, because I don't have a publisher right now. And it used to be the song pluggers and the vice president in charge of promotion to get these songs out there and be heard by somebody. And, you know, I can go out and do it myself, which I should be doing, which is what it all boils down to, you know. But I have a hard time doing it.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a seminar you could offer or something like that. You know, Radio Free Nashville seminar, song booking or something.
Would it be worth your while to hire a plugger? And I understand there's plugger deals where some pluggers are on like a draw, and then there's other pluggers that only get paid if you get paid, and they kind of get it on the back end kind of thing.
Yep. There's all kind of plugger deals.
All kind of plugger deals, yeah. So maybe that's a...
Well, I've done those too.
Yeah.
And, well, I just don't know. If I don't have enough nouns, I don't think...
you're gonna have to tell everybody this story on that, man.
Okay, well, I was writing with this guy. He'll remain nameless, but this was a couple of years ago. At first, I thought he was kidding. He started banging on the desk in the middle of our co-writing session, going, nouns, damn it, nouns, nouns, damn it. Why are you giving me all these adjectives and adverbs and everything like that? Don't you know I've made my living off of nouns, especially proper nouns? Let's have some Evinrude or some, come on, Miller Lite or something in there. Come on, man, what's wrong with you? And that kind of opened my eyes to what's actually going on down on Music Row, you know. I'm going to get a little beautiful embroidered plaque that I'm going to hang on my wall someday. It's going to say, nouns, damn it, nouns.
So you think that whole thing is representative of what's really going on in town? You think he was right? If you want to succeed, there's like, you got to like, you can't just write what you want. You got to kind of write what the market wants, well, kind of a thing.
That's definitely true. But I guess that's always been true to a certain extent. I'm just wondering if there is a Music Row left anymore.
Mm.
Or if things are perhaps, you know, we were talking about the internet earlier, but perhaps the internet is good for that. You know, maybe it's going to spread things out a little bit. I don't know.
Remember how when we were young, we'd buy the 45?
Yeah.
And in fact, the Beatles even, their singles were never on their albums. They were only on the 45s. I'm pretty sure of that. And it seems like it's kind of come full circle, or full half circle, or full something, to where now it's back that way now, where people don't want the whole collection of songs. They just want one particular song so they can put together their own compilation album. And so it's almost questioning the whole idea of, like, you know, spending all kinds of money and time and producing an album when people are just going to not really want the album. They're just going to want one particular. The question is, which song are they going to want?
Right.
And if you knew that, you could just do the one song and not do the other 9 or 10 or 11.
Yeah, and the whole thing we grew up with, the whole process of listening to an album, like we were talking about earlier,
yeah,
where it's an experience where you listen to both sides and you, yeah, get deeply into it. I don't think.
Look at the album art and all the, you know, it was a whole experience, a whole evening, you know.
Yeah. It take you on a journey. But that's not, like you said, it's one song at a time now, so I better get the good one. It's better be full of nouns.
Let's listen to, I want you to tell us a little bit about Hillbilly. No, I mean, Billy Hill, sorry. I'm a little dyslexic.
That's easily done there, right?
Billy Hill. I'm Just a Rebel. This is a CD I'm holding here, Reprise Records. And what's the date on this thing? 1989. Tell us about Billy Hill.
Billy Hill was an outgrowth of my band, the Wolves in Cheap Clothing. And we used to buy our clothes at the Goodwill and make sure they were cheap suits possible and cheap shoes and cheap ties. We were big in ties.
I love the pun.
And, it was a great, great band, and eventually got signed to Warner Brothers. And their legal department said, well, you can't be called the Wolves, even if it's in cheap clothing, because there's already a band on Warner Brothers called the Wolves out in California. And
Warner's is Reprise.
Right. So that ain't going to happen, boys. They come up with a new name. And so that's how Billy Hill came about. It's Hillbilly backwards, but nobody ever got that part of it.
So why don't we listen to Too Much Month at the End of the Money, which is another, I don't know if that's a pun. What do you call that?
The whole band was a pun, man. Don't look any further than that.
You want to say anything about this song?
No, except that it's appropriate right now.
Yes, I paid the bank note, the car note, and yes, I paid the phone bill too. And then I turned around and I found that the house notes you. Well, I'd love to check you out like I said I would, honey, but there's too much month at the end of the money. Well, I got a little favor, wanna ask of you, my love. Why don't you find that hole in my pocket and sew it up? Yeah, I thought I saved some, but you know it's funny. There's too much month at the end of the money. Oh, 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 heaven only knows. Oh, 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 where on earth it goes. But it sure goes where sometimes I think it goes. Anyway, this morning about 9:30.
a little something in the credit line. But the man said, look what you got here, son, is too much month at the end of the money. I'd love to take you out like I said I would, honey, but there's too much month at the end of the money. Too much month at the end of the money.
Too much month at the end of the money. You want to tell them that story about the New Faces show?
Oh, dear, dear, dear. Well, okay, if you want to hear it. What year was that?
It has to do with this band, 1989.
Okay, so it would have been 89.
Billy Hill.
Recently signed to Warner Brothers. I don't know if you folks know about the New Faces show, but it's a chance for labels to showcase their acts for all the program directors and DJs in the country, and they all come to Nashville. It used to be in October, I guess it still is. And so here we are, brand new on the label, and this is our chance to shine. And but the only trouble is that the show's at noon in a big auditorium with open windows and the sun pouring through. We'd never even been up at noon before, let alone play a show. You know? But we're backstage going there, man. We got to rock them. This is our chance, man. This is it. This is, if we don't do it now, this is, we're going to miss it. This is our opportunity. This is, we got to do it, man. Are we going to rock them? We're going to rock them. So we're clapping each other on the back like a football team. And went out there and cranked it up, and we rocked them all right. You could see them out there in the audience. The old program director's been drinking all night, and they had their hands over their ears, and they were going, oh, geez, oh, God. Laying their heads on the tables and their foreheads, you know. But we just rocked on. You know, we got backstage and we said, did we rock them? Yeah, we rocked them. So we had to catch a bus to a gig we were doing in Florida. But we had a little bit of time. So let's hang out and see what these other new faces are, see if they can rock them like we did. So we hung out backstage, peeked through the curtains, and the first act up there was Alan Jackson. And we said, he didn't rock him.
We did better than he did.
Yeah, oh yeah. He didn't rock him at all, man. You can tell. And then the next one up there was Garth Brooks. The New Faces show. Well, I guess he rocked him. I don't know. We had to leave because our bus was leaving. We got to hear one song from Garth.
Have you had Garth cuts?
No. Never have. We came real close. He cut a song that we wrote and called us up one afternoon and said, boys, I'm in the studio. Called Dennis Robbins. This is great. And he actually held the phone up to the speaker so we could hear what he was doing. And we all gathered around the telephone. Oh, that sounds... We were so excited for about 3 hours. Because that was back when that would have completely changed your world.
Yeah. You know?
And then Garth called back about 3 hours later, called Dennis and said, man, I've tried all afternoon to sing that song, and no matter how I try, I just sound just like Alan Jackson, so I'm not gonna try.
How do you think Garth changed the whole music business? Would you agree with that statement?
Well, he certainly was instrumental in it. I don't know if he changed it single-handedly, but he put another spark in it that drew everybody from California,
mm-hmm.
thinking that there was big money to be made here, and that changed it.
Do you think that changed the way people wrote the kinds of songs that the publishers were looking for and the producers and the artists were looking for?
No, Jimmy Bowen changed that years earlier.
Okay.
Yeah. No, Garth was almost still trying to do what I would consider real songwriting, or at least to be involved with it, you know, compared to, I don't know, all the nouns that we have now.
You have an, you've already kind of, you know, kind of gave us indirectly some of your views about today's music business, but you just want to... Just to ask you very directly, what do you think of the present day music business in terms of what it is and what's getting cut and how it's getting cut and where it leaves writers that have had a long track record of having success as writers and where that kind of leads them today. If I'm asking that in a coherent way.
Yeah, in terms of that, it's problematic. I don't know these the writer of yesterday has got to either give up or change or find a new venue, you know, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that the kids, that's what they're aiming the music at. The kids, I understand the impulse there, and the kids want to rock. I understand that. There's nothing wrong with it. But this isn't rock.
Yeah.
This is bubblegum.
Yeah.
Why would you give the kids of this day and age bubblegum to latch onto? I have no idea. Mm-hmm. That I'm clueless about.
Mm-hmm.
There's no meat. It's all potato salad, Buck.
Mm-hmm. You look for it to change? You got a prognosis about everything? You think it's gonna eventually spin back and revert back to, you know, to more old school kinds of stuff, or what do you think? What's the trajectory look like to you?
I keep saying that it will, but you know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Is that wishful thinking?
Yeah. Now I got a buddy who says that the reason he moved to Nashville and wanted to come down here and give it a shot as a writer and a player, and I'm, you know, try to draw some attention down here. That a lot of it had to do with a song you wrote called "Modern Day Drifter." And I'm going to ask you to play that live here in a minute. But what do you have a story on that song? How you came to write it and where the lyric came from and the whole concept? Did you write that alone?
No, that was a co-written song, but the impetus for that thing, I think, was almost toward the beginning of all that dissolution of what we used to know of as Music Row, you know. And you might as well go back out on the road and become a modern-day drifter at that point in time, you know.
Mm-hmm. But, you remember that Kirk Douglas movie called Lonely Are the Brave?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that in a sort of... like that in a way, do you think?
Yeah.
Why don't you play that for us? John Scott Sherrill and
I gotta tune this thing up here.
Tune that thing up. You are listening to Radio Free Nashville 107.1, and I'm Ty. This is Ty Tune, and John Scott Sherrill is my guest. He's had 11 number one songs get cut, and God knows how many songs he's written. I'm gonna ask him here some point.
Yeah, there's no trip was over, and would it be okay if I didn't know the way? And if I gave you my hand, would you take it and make me the happiest man in the world? If I told you my heart couldn't beat one more minute without you, girl, would you accompany me to the edge of the sea. Help me tap the ends of a dream. I love you so. Would you go with me? Could you not look down forever if you were lighter than a feather? And if I set you free, would you go with me? And if I gave you my hand, would you take it and make me the happiest man in the world? If I told you my heart couldn't be without you, girl, would you accompany me to the edge of the sea? Help me tie up the ends of a dream. I love you so. Would you go with me? Come on, baby.
Scott Sherrill, Would You Go With Me? It was a recent number one hit by Josh Turner. Man, do you have a most covered song that you...
Most covered?
Yeah.
Probably The Church on Cumberland Road, I think, probably.
You know how many different artists have covered that?
Oh, just a whole bunch of mostly mid-level... rock bands. But... Hey, man, you know.
It's money in the mailbox.
That's
right,
man. You gotta love it, man.
You're listening to Radio Free Nashville, WRFNLP Pasco, and hit writer John Scott Sherrill is my guest. And we got an hour left in our show. We're going to get into all kinds of stuff for the next hour. Do you have a most requested song when you go out and do a public appearance?
Oh, probably over all the years, I'd have to say probably Nothing But the Wheel would be most requested.
Nothing But the Wheel? Want to play that for us?
Well, we're going to get onto that toward the end of the show, I think. Is
that the one we got? The Stones?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can delve in.